Welcome to CounselorAudioSource.net. Counselor Audio Source is a weekly podcast dedicated to the professional enhancement of practicing counselors, supervisors, and counselor educators. Look for us on the web at CounselorAudioSource.net. I'm Dr. Marty Gentius from Kent State University, and this week on Counselor Audio Source, I speak with Dr. Paul Granello, Associate Professor at The Ohio State University, about the importance of including wellness in counseling. I'm at Ohio State University today with a friend and colleague, Dr. Paul Granello, and he is with us today and going to talk a little bit about wellness and counseling. Paul, thanks for joining us on Counselor Audio Source.
Great to be here, Marty.
What does the term wellness mean?
This is interesting because when you look in the literature, you're going to see all kinds of strange terms being used. Everything from holistic to preventative to holistic, spelled W-H-O-L. All these strange terms around disease management, disease prevention, all this kind of stuff. And I think for me, wellness is actually a term we are using in counseling in particular to mean an emergent healthcare paradigm in this country. And it's an approach to treating people in a preventative, taking a preventative approach, which is a somewhat of a departure from the traditional medical model. I think wellness represents a philosophic change. So when I talk about paradigm change, I'm really the term is bigger than just meaning looking at all the different parts and pieces of someone and treating all those things or whatever. I mean, wellness really is a lifestyle philosophy which goes beyond being healthy. And that it's kind of radical, actually. If you look at our traditional medical model and you look at sort of the idea that disease is caused by a pathogen. And so when you go to the doctor looks for, by looking at your symptoms, they try to identify what's causing the symptoms. They don't treat the cough. They try to treat the underlying germ or the underlying pathogen that is causing the problem. I think in health, as if we looked at this as a continuum with sort of illness and pathogen on one side, and we look at health as kind of in the middle, health is sort of an absence of disease. It is not being sick. And I think if we continue down the continuum, you get towards wellness. And this is where it's a little more radical than our understanding of what health is today. Wellness is deliberately building factors into your lifestyle, which I would call salutogens. It's kind of the opposite of a pathogen.
A salutogen
is something you build into your lifestyle that promotes well-being. So for the first time in our history, for the first time in Western history and our science, we have a pretty good idea of characteristics and behaviors that people can engage in that can promote their well-being. And when I talk about well-being, I'm talking about longevity and quality of life. Because, you know, it's no good to live a long time if you're not well. If you're not feeling good, you don't have a good quality of life. So those two things go hand in hand. So examples of salutogens is obviously the common ones that we talk about in terms of exercise, in terms of certain type of diet, which would be high-fiber, low-fat diet. We know other factors in terms of emotional management factors, stress management factors, humor, intellectual stimulation, preventative sort of self-care. These different models promote different salutogenic factors. So I guess what I'm trying to say is if we look at this continuum, Wellness is a little bit more than just saying you're not sick.
And it's a little bit more than saying you're healthy.
Right. It's going beyond that. And actually, wellness is really seeking to incorporate into your lifestyle practices that are going to build up your immune functioning, build up your system such that you are maximizing your or optimizing your potential mm-hmm. in terms of longevity, quality of life, et cetera, et cetera.
When you've used the word prevention in there, and I think one of the things that attracted me as a young person interested in counseling was that the counseling field talked about prevention. However, during my practice of it, we didn't get much of that process included. Is this coming about again now with wellness?
Yeah, I mean, the roots of counseling, the foundations of counseling are all about wellness. They're mm-hmm. all about development. They're all about prevention. You know, there's different factors that come into play, and I think I'll, you know, illustrate this a little bit. There's science, and then there's the economics of practice. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think counseling as a field was perverted, particularly in the 1980s, in terms of mental health, and people wanted to move into areas where the money was. Mm-hmm. That was private practice enterprise, and we saw a lot of people getting into diagnosis and treatment because, let's face it, people need to earn a living, mm-hmm. and that's where you could earn a living. I remember when I was working in Orlando in the early 1980s, we had several very upper-class drug treatment mm-hmm. hospitals, and they had the magic 28-day cure. And you know, a couple of those places were charging $35,000, $45,000 a pop for these kids coming in and out of these drug treatment. Well, what all happened by the end of the 1980s, we know managed care came into play. The economic game was kind of ruined. I don't think any of those places are still in business because there just isn't the buck to be made. And I think a lot of counselors who went into practices and a lot of agencies who thought they had a cash cow and sort of bought into the traditional model of pathogen diagnosis, whatever, have been disillusioned now by the change in economic situation. And I you know, for me, the future of counseling is getting back more to our roots. It's getting back more to looking at people developmentally, mm-hmm. holistically, looking at these different lifestyle factors and how we get people to implement them.
So you're saying it got worse, and now it's going to get better. So why wellness
now? It may
get
better. I don't know if it will get better. I mean, because, you know, and another thing about counseling is we're often behind the eight ball. We often respond rather than lead. And I could talk about, you know, kind of why wellness is an emergent paradigm now. I would like to say it's because if you look at general healthcare, if you look at healthcare overall, it's moving towards wellness. It's moving towards more disease prevention, more disease management. And, you know, I would like to say that's because all of a sudden we've become enlightened and we care about people and we want to prevent them from getting sick. I mean, the reality is that that the economics are such that we don't have a choice. Because right now we're spending $1.6 trillion a year on healthcare in this country. It will be by 2006, 2007, it's now representing 16% of our gross domestic product. Mm-hmm. By 2020, Medicare alone will represent 11%. Just Medicare program will represent 11% of our gross domestic product. Prescription increases have gone up 17% in the last 2-3 years. They're mm-hmm. incredible. So it's not all of a sudden that there's this big medical model enlightenment idea, and that's why we're having paradigm change. We're getting medicine is being pushed into using science for more disease prevention, whatever, because We can't do what we've traditionally done in this country. We just can't afford to do it anymore. We wait till people get sick, and then we respond to them with high technology.
So we've priced ourselves out of getting people well, or taking care of the disease, and instead we're trying to price ourselves into doing things that prevent it.
Right, exactly. And what's happening is that, look, if I go out today and we leave the building today and we go get some lunch and I get hit by a bus and on High Street here in Columbus and my head gets crushed, there's no darn place I'd rather be than the United States. I mean, if there's any way that they are going to save your life, I mean, it's the best medical care in the world for emergency care, surgery. People from all over the world who have money come to the United States for their heart care, their cancer care, and all that, because the technology, premature baby care, for example. I mean, my brother works at the Arnold Palmer Hospital for Women and Children in Orlando. They have light sensors that can read vital signs off of infants without even touching them. I mean, it's amazing stuff. The problem with that is that instead of keeping the person from having the heart attack in the first place, we have got to a place where we'll spend $300,000 on surgery and rehab and time missed from work and all of that stuff. So we've gotten really good. Medicine has gotten very good at saving you once you're ill. But what we haven't succeeded on is keeping people from getting ill in the first place. In fact, we've gone backwards on that. And when the running craze was in this country, and I automatically think of Forrest Gump, the whole sequence where he's running and running. But that capturing that running craze, the heart rate, the heart cardiac incidence, was the only time that that ever went down when people were jogging. When we were in the jogging craze. Since that time, it's gotten worse. In the 1990s, it's gotten particularly worse in terms of rates of obesity in the adult population. Obesity is important because it leads to diabetes and heart disease and all those things. So we look at our rates, and they're skyrocketing, and it's also frightening with children. So we have these high costs, high technology, highly invasive treatment modalities. Now, that's great. If you're sick and you need a heart angioplasty or a stent or whatever, but we're not using our science and our technology, and it's cheaper to keep people well than it is to treat someone after they're sick. Mm-hmm. And I think what motivates people now, when you start seeing people who are against smoking, like in certain restaurants, and now in Columbus it's in all bars. Mm-hmm. Now it's on campus here, it's outside of buildings, there's no smoking anymore. And people are more empathetic to that because they're beginning to understand that once you're in managed care, you're sharing the same pool economically. So if Marty doesn't take care of himself and is a heavy smoker, who pays for that? Everybody in the pool pays for that. So as the rates go up, people get more interested in managing health care. And so right now at OSU, for example, we have a program where if you choose to participate in a smoking cessation or in a weight management or whatever, you can get a reduction in your healthcare cost. So it's a carrot approach. I think eventually what will happen is the stick approach will come into play also, where if you choose not to manage your lifestyle and do these things and you fall into a high risk category, that you'll be paying extra insurance. And so I think we'll see this. So I would like to say that it's the science of, you know, that we've gotten to this place where we can detect a lot of things and whatever that has brought us sort of this paradigm change, that we've gotten very empathetic about wanting to keep people well and all that. And there is that. But I think if we look at the realities, that most paradigm changes, I think this paradigm change is being driven by economics. It's being driven by dollars and cents. And so while wellness and disease management and all that has altruistic, and that's how they sell it to the public often, and the realities are it's about money. And it's about the medical system being able to sustain itself. And where big medicine goes, where main medicine goes, behavioral medicine will follow.
Okay.
Because we represent a small part of the total market, and behavioral medicine and counseling and psychology and psychiatry even are just a small percentage of total medicine. But where the big medicine changes and big medicine goes, behavioral medicine will be part of that mm-hmm. system and will come along with that.
Well, you know, one of the things I like to do with this podcast is not only is hear some good conversations about information, but I just to take a side moment and ask you a little bit about your interests. You were a practitioner and now a researcher, and what pulled you into wellness and looking at wellness as a researcher, writer, and practitioner?
I think from a mental health perspective, when I was graduated with my master's degree and went to work for a community mental health agency, and then in a drug treatment center, and then at a hospital and a partial hospital, and these, I was always attracted to working with very sick clients.
Mm-hmm.
And so I worked with people who had severe psychotic disorders, severe mood disorders, anxiety disorders, and I just really liked working with the most sick client mm-hmm. or the most disturbed clients. And I had a little fascination that as I began to work with these folks, it always occurred to me that what if we could go back in time with these people? What if I could have intervened not now after they're in the hospital, not now after they've been involved with this illness, you know, for 10 years? What if we had gone back and started interacting with these people, you know, a long time ago? And my belief was is that if not cured, because there is biological and genetic basis mm-hmm. to many of these, but that the severity of these problems would have been tremendously reduced.
Its expression wouldn't have been as...
Exactly. These people would have had much different lives. Their functioning would have been much different. And mm-hmm. and then I was went to Ohio University and was influenced there by Mel Whitmer, mm-hmm. who is now retired and living in Hilton Head, so he must have done something right along the way. And I think he invested in Wendy's stock or something. But Mel, by the way, doesn't get enough credit. He is one of the top contributors to JCD of all time yeah. in terms of the number of articles. And I mean, he chaired over 80 dissertations.
Yeah.
So I mean, you talk about a person who's kind of under the radar in terms of, you know, how well he's known or whatever.
But in the counselor education field, his name just, it keeps coming
yeah,
up in terms of his
and
influence.
He started teaching in the 1970s a class called Stress and Biofeedback, because that's where the research was mm-hmm. at that time. And then as that progressed into the 80s and 90s, it became wellness, mm-hmm. stress and biofeedback. And I was very influenced by him, and I ended up doing my dissertation on wellness. And just got very fascinated with this whole idea of what are characteristics of a well person, mm-hmm. and can we engender those characteristics in people and encourage them to pursue those characteristics to avoid getting sick mm-hmm. or minimize the severity of illness. And of course, during that time, significantly driven by HIV research, AIDS research, was the whole looking into the immune system, and mm-hmm. psychoneuroimmunology came about, which was the whole idea of mind affecting, moods affecting the immune system. And now, of course, we have some very well-established links between immune functioning and depression and immune functioning and stress and all of that stuff. And so the science has really come a long way in terms of what we understand is healthy and not healthy.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I was kind of ragging on the medical model of things, and I don't want to totally beat up on MDs or the medical model, because I think medicine has done. There are a few areas in which medicine has done some really good things. I think statin drugs
mm-hmm.
for managing cholesterol.
Something both you and I are very familiar
with. I think statin drugs. I think blood pressure. Mm-hmm. blood pressure medications. I think diabetes management has greatly improved. I think that these are preventative in the sense that being able to use screening to detect early, especially if you're someone with a genetic history, and detect screening and take these medications as a preventative measure, I would encourage people to do that. I'm not an anti-medicine person. I don't want to give that impression. Mm-hmm. I'm an anti-invasive, costly technology as the answer to, you know, that's kind of the 1950s mentality that came about, you know, that we could invent any engineer, any technology, we could have a technological solution to any problem. And this is where medicine is falling flat on its face right now, because we have all these knowledge about how to keep people well, but they can't get people to do it.
Yeah, we still have a lot of obesity. We still have a lot of
disease. Have all these lifestyle problems because they're not technological answers. And even if you come up with a pill, there's huge problems with compliance.
Mm-hmm.
There's huge problems with compliance. And even when you talk to clients and you say, why aren't you doing your diabetes tests or your glucose tests or whatever, and they know, intellectually they know, that they need to do these things, or people know they need to exercise more. Or, you know, I've done groups at the university now with about 100 faculty. Now, remember, these are supposedly very well educated, some of the most educated people in our society. And I ask them, how often do you need to exercise or whatever? They don't say, oh, you know, whatever. They say 30 minutes or more than days a week than not. I mean, they know the actual prescription, you know. Or I ask them about diet. They can tell me all the information and all the knowledge. Then I say, well, why do you do it? Or do you know, you know? And the answer is no, you know. So you look at the disconnect between, it's just not about information and it's just not about knowledge and or science or understanding these things. And that, and this is where counseling really has power.
Mm-hmm.
This is where counseling really fits into the whole wellness approach to taking care of people, because what do counselors do?
They deal with the discrepancy between what you know should happen and what isn't happening.
Counselors help people make lifestyle changes.
Right.
Even when you're treating someone for depression, you don't get them to be undepressed. You know, I mean, you don't stop them from being depressed. You get them to implement lifestyle changes that are contrary to maintaining the depression.
Mm-hmm.
You get them to start moving and walking. You get them to start engaging in social connections. You get them to start, you know, getting emotional stuff out and communicating and sharing. You get them, you know, all from a cognitive perspective, refuting irrational thoughts, and, you know, they take action to resolve that problem. And I think the same thing is true for the general public in terms of improving lifestyles. Counselors are skilled at developing treatment interventions, treatment plans, making reasonable, measurable goals and objectives, and supporting people using techniques to do that. And whether that's dealing with mental health problem or whether that's making a successful lifestyle change,
mm-hmm.
counselors have those skills. Counselors have those assessment and treatment planning and intervention support skills that can help people do this. And this is why counselors need to be at the table as providers, as this healthcare paradigm change comes apart, you know, comes not apart, comes about.
Would you say counselors are probably best suited for that role too, out of the whole wellness piece?
I think counselors are tremendously suited,
mm-hmm.
and I think that we're missing the boat by not getting on top of this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, psychology is usurping. Is going to be usurping this role.
Mm-hmm.
Psychologists are better organized. APA is better funded.
Mm-hmm.
The Templeton Foundation, which is the a private foundation that supports research in psychology, they sponsored and gave away $500,000 for research into what they're calling positive psychology.
Hmm.
And Martin Seligman, who was president of APA and is no longer, but is coined the term positive psychology.
Right.
He currently has doing research with his websites on positive psychology, and he's got tens of thousands of people who are members of this website and logging in and seeing. He's got free lifestyle assessments and other things going on. And for years defending the whole pathology approach that psychology took, and that I think counseling got into in the 1980s, particularly when it was a profit area. Counseling needs to assert its original foundations, its roots, and look at human development and look at healthy growth over the lifetime and look at lifestyle and these kinds of things and get back to that. And otherwise, other professions will be at the table. Mm-hmm. And that'll be a shame, because I do think counselors are uniquely qualified. Can be, and I'm biased. I think there should be more wellness education infused into the counselor education curriculum.
Which brings me to a question about counselor education and fitting into the wellness healthcare, and the idea of counselor educators kind of bringing in wellness. How can they do that within programs?
Well, there's multiple ways to do this. You could do, depending upon how much buy-in you have from a particular faculty. What I've done here at OSU is we have a course. Mm-hmm. We have a wellness course. And that's a really nice, intensive kind of experience, and it meets one of our criteria for a clinical requirement for state licensure or whatever. The problem with a single course, just like with multiculturalism, is that students may view that experience in isolation mm-hmm. and not see the application of that content to every other course that they take. So they take a multicultural course, but they don't see how that fits in with group or fits in with family or whatever. And so another way to approach this is sort of an infusion model across the curriculum. And in order to do that, you have to have cooperation of faculty. Mm-hmm. And you have to you sit down with faculty and you look at the courses across the program and you say, can you include an objective in your course that relates to wellness? How will, in substance abuse class, you have something that has to do with, wellness and looking at wellness and whatever? I mean, a lot of what I've done in my substance abuse courses, when I look at relapse prevention, and you look at the fact that addicts and alcoholics have to oftentimes develop new lifestyles mm-hmm. for themselves when they're giving up a lifestyle that was toxic and harmful, they have to learn new skills of how to recreate, how to interact with people, substance-free. To me, that's wellness, because they have to develop a lifestyle that's going to be enhancing, life-enhancing, as opposed to, detrimental. Mm-hmm. You could easily do an objective like that. So an infusion model would take each course and sort of say, how can we relate this topical area? The most radical way to do wellness, which Mel Whitmer and I, if I had complete control over a counseling program, I would give every student who comes into the program a wellness assessment. Hmm. We would set goals and objectives for them and their growth while they're in the program. I would have all the faculty working on individual wellness plans. And we would, across the spectrum, this would just be something that goes on. Like, when you look at impaired counselors, or we look at trying to produce people who are going to go out and be caretakers, and we know in today's mental health care environment, you're working with a lot of severe cases, people who have had trauma, people, these are my interns are working with caseloads that when I was going through internship, we would have considered outrageous. Yeah. I think there's an amplification of pathology because of what's happened to the community mental health care system and other things, and again, economic forces that come into play. When I was going through my internship, if I had a person who had been sexually abused as a child with an eating disorder, either that case would have been given to a more senior therapist, mm-hmm. or I would have been very closely supervised. And now with my
And maybe have a reduced caseload.
Yeah,
as you're
right.
Dealing
yeah,
with this
yeah,
intense
yeah.
case.
And you know what happens today is almost all of my students have numerous case. I mean, most of them, all of their clients have some sort of traumatic mm-hmm. histories and problems and whatever. So when you look at just the stress of what they're coping with, whatever, it seems to me that if we were really caring about students and we were really talking about growth enhancement and all the things in counseling that we supposedly talk about, we should be promoting in our programs a wellness agenda. Mm. We should be preparing people to go out and have lifestyles that are building them up, helping them cope with stress, making them prepared to work in mental health, which is a can be a very stressful profession.
Well, I'm thinking about the counselor who might be listening to this podcast and saying, okay, I get it. This is something that I have always believed in. How do I start to incorporate wellness into my work with clients? What are some steps I can take?
The first thing I would do is do a little background work. I would learn about wellness a little bit. Myers and Sweeney had an ACA book that came out in 2005. Actually wrote a chapter in that book with Mel about counselor education and that kind of approach. You learn a model. When I think of wellness, I often think of kind of a technical eclecticism. Mm-hmm. Because when you're looking at different factors that you may consider when you're treatment planning or working with a person around different areas in their life they may want to work on to improve their overall well-being, you have to know a little something about all of those things, you know, to kind of do that, or know where to triage that person to send them to do it. For example, when I've had clients that were a little bit more affluent and it was an exercise issue or a physical activity issue, I have people in Columbus that I know are personal trainers or people in exercise science here at the university that I'll send that person to get an assessment, to get a plan together. I mean, I'm not going to do that as a counselor,
sure.
But I'm going to coordinate that for the person. So we may develop a treatment plan and have as a goal, you know, developing a regular exercise program, and we may send that out to consult. Or same thing around nutrition and diet. I'm not a nutritionist, but we can certainly set a goal in a treatment of, you know, having a nutritional consult, mm-hmm. what were the results of that, and then as a counselor, how do I motivate that person to continue to follow through, what is the plan, how did they do it, all that.
So, you know, explore, get a little learning in terms of yourself, but also becoming aware of, you know, incorporating into treatment plans, but becoming aware of the resources out there.
Absolutely.
That you can start to build into the clients.
Right, right. And these wellness models exist in the literature. There's the lifespan model, which Mel Whitmer developed over time, and which Whitmer and Sweeney and Myers have, you know, through statistical work refined over time. David Zimfer published a model, a wellness model in the literature, which he specifically works with cancer patients. And it's interesting to note in David's model, there's a lot of emphasis on spirituality and meaning and whatever, because these people are, mm-hmm. you know,
addressing those existential
coping with that, and some of them, you know, terminal cancer. Very interesting. I want to differentiate there the difference between wellness and health, because someone can be quite unhealthy and have cancer and yet be pretty well in how they cope with it. I'm thinking about, Darcy, my wife, who has MS, mm-hmm. who has a pretty serious illness. But if you see her functioning, I think she's pretty well.
And that's separating the disease out from the individual.
Exactly.
Whereas with the more pathology, the disease seems really connected to the individual.
Right.
And wellness says you can still have a disease but still also be very well.
For instance, we know that there are some people who have major mood disorders, bipolar disorder, major depressive disorders, that despite having those, function pretty highly, that they're pretty well and cope with the realities of that. And we know other people who have those illnesses who adopt, you know, victim identities, and, mm-hmm. you know, that sort of becomes who they are, as a patient, as an ill person, mm-hmm. instead of a well person. And I think, so the separating out that, I want to give a caveat too, and then I'll talk a little bit more about the incorporating into counseling. One caveat is, I'm not a wellness Nazi. I'm not one of the things I don't like about a lot of people that are in the quote-unquote alternative healthcare marketplace, and I use that word very specifically, is that they sort of get into blaming. Mm-hmm. And I think it's really important for counselors to adopt an attitude not to say the person is sick because they did these habits, or, you know, you could easily blame someone, you know, for mm-hmm. being, and we're not into the blaming game. We're into,
we've got friends and relatives who can do that.
Yes,
for us.
Exactly. We're into the helping people feel better game, yeah. and how to do that. And I think counselors have the skills to make very reasonable goals for people, very measurable, attainable goals, so that people, once they attain something small in some small direction, get some momentum going, they get some self-efficacy, mm-hmm. they say, maybe I can do this. Oftentimes I talk to my students, you know, sometimes it's better to address a small issue rather than the main issues mm-hmm. in treatment first. Because if you can get the patient or get the client to be successful about some small area.
Minimal change theory.
Exactly. And they get to feel some momentum, and there's ripple effects and, mm-hmm. and all those things, like in our brief solution focus colleagues would love. And
yeah.
and you get into all that cycle of improvement and change and build that sense of self-efficacy. Mm-hmm. Getting back to integrating wellness work into private practice, I wrote an article in 2000 that's in the Journal of Psychotherapy and Independent Practice, if people want to read that. And it talks about all of the skills that you now use for assessment, for treatment planning, for goal setting, all of these same skills where we're focusing on sort of pathology, you can flip around mm-hmm. and treat clients from a wellness approach. So the things I think you need to do is you need to develop a sense of wellness and a wellness model, and what are the different characteristics and things that are inclusive in your model. I think sometimes just educating a client about wellness and a model. Mm-hmm. I think whenever we give clients a paradigm to follow, they kind of follow it.
Mm-hmm.
I really like that about like the steps of grief. Like you tell clients, you know, they're going to go through this grief process and there are these steps, and they do for us. And I think when we give them these meta models and cognitive models, and the same thing about wellness, when you teach a wellness model, whether there's emotional, intellectual, spiritual, you know, physical components to it, the same thing is true with that. And then so many of the skills counselors already know can be applied to this. Often there are paper and pencil assessments you can give. Mm-hmm. There's the WELL, which is the Wellness Evaluation of Lifestyle. There's the TEST WELL, which is put out by the National Wellness Institute in Stevens Point, Wisconsin. So these are paper and pencil indices. Often clients like that, they mm-hmm. like to see results. They like to see a graph. They can compare their progress And often there's clinical utility in identifying areas that they may want to work on by looking at those assessment and then helping clients develop good goals. That's mm-hmm. one of the best things counselors can bring, because so many people fail, not because they're not well-intentioned, but because their goals were unrealistic and they don't get success and they get discouraged mm-hmm. and they quit. 80% of people who start exercising drop out after the first 3 months.
Wow.
So, you know, in New Year's, in January, I know my gym's going to be real busy with all the New Year's resolution people and whatever. But they get unrealistic about the results, the instant results. And so by March, things are going to get back pretty much to normal.
If you're looking for a good fitness deal package, you should probably hit sometime around May.
Yeah, they're low on their new their low season, right. Right. Wouldn't be in January.
Yeah.
But that's the idea, that people, helping people set realistic goals, setting measurable objectives, and providing encouragement and support.
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of people, of course, are in families and are in systems and relationships, which even though the partners and significant others or social systems may say they want the person to start being more well or whatever, when it comes to changing behavior, they're not really supportive of that person.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, if dad may say to mom, yeah, you really need to lose weight and get physically active. Well, when she starts going to the gym after work 3 days a week and his dinner is not on the table at 6 o'clock or 7 o'clock, you know, he begins to say, hey, where are you? Why aren't you home? Why isn't dinner on the table?
And why are you feeding me all this green stuff?
Why are the kids not, you know, I mean, people don't like to change the dance, really. They get confused when you start changing. And I've had so many women say to me, you know, one of the reasons I don't go to the gym is my husband gets jealous, you know, if I go to the gym or you know. So you have to look at the whole social support network and all those kinds of things. And I think this is why physicians often fail with treatment, because they're not looking at the whole
system.
Picture, the whole system. So
those are all good pieces of advice for a counselor who wants to start to enter and explore this paradigm of wellness. Do you have any closing thoughts for us?
Yeah, get into the literature around it. The more you read about it, the more interesting it is.
Mm-hmm.
Learn about a model. Learn the resources in your community. Let it be known that you're a person who has this orientation, and you will attract a certain clientele.
Hmm.
Who is interested in this approach. They don't want to focus on all the problems and all the staying stuck in your whole, you know, sick, sad life, but they want things to be better and work at making things better. It's just, I found that clinically working with people from more of a wellness orientation is just a lot more positive.
Hmm.
It's not depressing, as depressing to work with people.
Yeah.
And I believe it is the future. It's the future of healthcare in this country, because it's the right thing to do and how to treat people and keep them well, because we have the technology to do that, but because of the economics and because that's what we have to do. We don't have a choice anymore.
We're going to take a collection of the references that you described through the podcast to make sure they're part of the show notes portion of the website at counselaudiosource.net. So some of the articles that you referred to, we'll have the full references for, so listeners can get those and get a little brushed up on some of the models and some of the other stuff.
And if people are interested and want to chat or want to whatever, they can always email me at grinnello.2@osu.edu.
And as part of your biography on the show notes page, we'll put that email address.
Awesome.
So that's available for our listeners. So thanks for doing this today. I really appreciate this conversation. It was fun.
Thanks for having me.
You've just heard an interview with Dr. Paul Grinnello about wellness in counseling, done by Counselor Audio Source editor Dr. Marty Gentius.
Look for previous podcasts, show notes, and listener feedback on the podcast website at counselaudiosource.net. Listeners can leave comments or questions for our interview guests or hosts through our Skype.com internet telephone ID, Counselor Audio Source, or by calling 330-871-4015. Counseling techniques and interventions discussed in the Counselor Audio Source broadcast are meant for use by counseling professionals, and Counselor Audio Source is not held liable for any use of the techniques mentioned in the program. Our music bed today is Memorial Day from Jamie Bochin. His and other PodSafe music can be found in the PodSafe Music Network at podshow.com. Counselor Audio Source is licensed under the Creative Commons, a nonprofit organization offering a flexible copyright for creative work.